You're listening to the GP Supervisors Australia podcast, supporting your registrar to provide best practice disability care, presented by Dr. Alison Lancey. We would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which this recording was produced and pay our respects to their elders past, present, future, and their families.
So this is a bit of a passion topic for me, and I am very passionate about providing best level care, and I'm very passionate about educating registrars as well. And I'm really keen for you to be reflecting on your own practice, reflecting on the barriers and maybe the disabled patients that you have in your practice for accessing healthcare. And also I'm going to address some issues with the NDIS, locating local services. And there's two websites that I'll direct you to. One is called My Community Directory, and you can type in the sort of that you're looking for, the location, and you can put in like the radius that you're looking for, whether it's 20 kilometres, 50 kilometres, 100 kilometres, and it will give you a list of services in that area. The other thing is on the NDIS website, there's local, they call them LAC partners, that are kind of based in different areas across Australia to provide some support to new patients to NDIS and let them know about local services that are available as well. Chat reviews is a paid assessment program for people with disabilities, questionnaire, I should say, and it's from within Queensland, an assessment tool. What does having a disability mean? And I guess this is what makes working in this area so tricky, is that having a disability can mean lots of different things. So someone like Hannah Gadsby, who's talked about how she was diagnosed with autism as an adult, managing her in general practice would be very different to managing Chris Van Ingen, who is an Australian actor and has cerebral palsy and is in a wheelchair. And then again, you've got someone like Adam Pearson, who's also an actor and advocator for people with facial difference. He's got neurofibromatosis that affects mainly his face. It causes quite significant disfigurement to his face. And in fact, he's fronting a campaign at the moment called I'm Not Your Villain. And it's to encourage film and television companies not to create a villain as part of the show that has facial scarring or a deformity or something else like that. And they released that campaign in response to the current James Bond film, because the current James Bond villain has got quite significant facial scarring. He's very much an advocate in that space. And then for those of you that have got little kids, you probably know Kirana Stanwell. So she's got a rare form of dwarfism, and she's an actor and presenter in Australia. And she has a great video of her on YouTube where she talks about the difficulties in her going to the post office because the counter is set so high that she can't physically kind of see the person on the other side of the counter. And she also can't reach to pay because the FBOS machine is set too high for her. So there's like just everyday barriers that people with disabilities often face. Someone like Dylan Alcott, who was born with a spinal tumor. And when that was resected, he became paraplegic. But he has recently... He's the only male tennis player to achieve a Golden Slam, which is winning 4 Grand Slams and an Olympic gold medal in the same year. So he's, you know, an amazing athlete. And then if you've seen The Greatest Showman, Sam Humphrey, who's got acrodysplasia, but he also has quite severe Crohn's disease, which again is another reminder that people with disabilities might have some other health condition that's going on that is often not managed very well because the focus tends to be on their disability. So that's why providing disability care in general practice and why registrars can be so difficult and why registrars can get quite overwhelmed. And then, of course, statistics in Australia, you've got about 4 in 10 Australians have a disability or a long-term health condition. But the things that I wanted to draw your attention to was that about 1 in 4 people who report sexual abuse have a disability, and people with disability are about 2.5 times more likely to experience domestic violence. And then one of the worst statistics, I think, is that 9 out of 10 women with intellectual disabilities have been sexually abused. So there's a lot of abuse that happens to people with disabilities in Australia. And there's things like poor ability to participate in workforce, higher risk of living in poverty, health costs are obviously higher, and there's even lower rates of school participation. So someone with a disability is often affected not just in their health, but in a range of areas, which can obviously contribute to worse health over time. So obviously I'm not going to go into this too much, but there's lots of different disabilities, as we've already talked about, affecting physical, intellectual, sensory, neurological, psych, physical disfigurement, developmental delay, all those sorts of things. So across a range of areas, as we've already discussed. And it's really important when you're talking with your registrars that it's important for them to think about how does this person's disability affect their mobility, their ability to provide self-care, their learning style, their communication, their self-management, social interaction, and also their capacity to make decisions. And thinking about those things will actually help you when you're guiding a person applying for the NDIS, because it's all about how their disability affects their function. And so you might have someone that's missing a leg, and yes, that's quite a severe disability, but actually they manage that quite well, and they're not really, still do their ADLs, they can still communicate fine, all those sorts of stuff. And so actually it doesn't affect their function that much, whereas you might get someone that's got autism that physically, you know, has all their limbs and physically looks completely fine, that has very severe deficits or impairment in function, their learning style, their communication, their social interactions, their self-management, and their capacity. So that's what's really important to be thinking about and assessing with these patients, particularly if it hasn't been done well before, and particularly when you're thinking about NDIS. So what are the barriers for you guys in your practice from patients that I've seen in the past? One was very small consulting spaces, and I had a patient who physically couldn't get his wheelchair, his motorized wheelchair, into the room because the doors were too narrow. I've had patients that I couldn't examine properly because the bed was at a fixed height. It couldn't be lowered down so that they could transfer across themselves from their wheelchair. There's often no lifter in your practice to be able to get a patient that's in a wheelchair onto a bed to examine them properly. So there's kind of physical barriers as well as lots of other things that occur. So there's things like financial, your practicalities in your facility, access to a disabled toilet, carers can be a big barrier to healthcare. Equipment, knowledge, the doctor and attitudes from staff, from the patient, from the carer, from society as a whole, and time is often really difficult as well. And location, so that's a big factor for people in very rural places where they can't access the same suite of services that perhaps the NDIS that you could if you lived somewhere like Sydney or Newcastle. So I want to talk about communication because I think it's a really important thing to be discussing with your registrars when they're doing these types of consults and thinking about what the challenges are for patients. So there's things like the most difficult series of fact sheets called cerebral palsy for general practitioners. And one is specifically about communication. I think it applies to lots of other disability areas. And there's the motor difficulties, motor planning, sequencing of speech, cognitive factors, so that if there's any intellectual cognitive impairment, that ability to understand the information that they're being told, sensory factors as well. So if there's vision problems, deafness, oral sensitivity can be a big challenge. But I think one of the biggest ones is confidence, feeling like you've been heard. And that's something that people with disabilities really do struggle with, because a lot of the time they've been gaslit and, oh, don't worry about it, or it's probably just your disability, or the information that's provided is not being seen as important as the information that someone else has provided. So lots of challenges for patients. And that's not including perhaps if someone is deaf and uses sign language and use of interpreters and things like that as well. So the sorts of things I would encourage you to discuss with your registrars. The big one is, how does your practice access an interpreter? So there's different ways of accessing an interpreter. There's the one if you're looking for another language, and that interpreting service is free across Australia. You just need to register your practice. So, and it's something that often is not discussed with registrars about how to do that. So I really encourage you to be talking with your registrar. But in terms of accessing a sign language interpreter, if a patient needs a sign language interpreter, they have to pay for that, or they have to apply for that through their NDIS. So that's just another little caveat now. That used to be a free service, and now you have to pay for it. And it can be quite expensive. There is a National Relay service that does video consults, but that's more supposed to be if someone is using a phone or telehealth. So that might be something if you need to access it quickly for a patient and you can't kind of organise one of the formal sign language interpreters. So I would encourage you guys to have a look into that and just talk about it with your registrar. But how does the patient prefer to communicate? I've seen patients with severe cerebral palsy, very bent over, non-verbal, and talked to mum and said, ask a question. And then she went, oh, hang on, I'll just ask. And she started signing to her child. And then they very quickly signed back and she was able to tell me what was going on. So I think it's important to encourage a registrar not to assume and to actually physically ask the question. Because some deaf people are very competent lip reading and others may prefer a sign interpreter. I think it's really important to, you know, speaking as you would to anyone of that age and gender, speaking directly to the patient, same as when you're dealing with interpreters or you talk to the patient. It's really easy trap to fall into, to talk to the carer or to the parent or to the person that comes with the patient, but it's really important to talk to the patient. Using appropriate volume, observing for verbal and non-verbal cues, letting patients time to process. So I've got a friend of mine who was for years kind of put in a sheltered workshop, assumed that had a low level of intelligence, but actually he took about 20 to 30 seconds to process information and to be able to give it. And so because people were not giving him that time to speak, he was kind of labelled as not being very intelligent. Once that was identified, he was able to enrol in open access university, and now he's studying law and German as a combined degree. So it's really important to give people the time to answer questions, to listening, checking they've been understood. And I think it's important to discuss with the registrar things like assessing capacity as well, and how you do that safely and with all the information that they have. So there have been masks that you could get that had a clear plastic part across the mouth so that people could lip read and still see. But yeah, it has been a big challenge for some. So I know many people wanted to ask about NDIS. On the NDIS website, there's an amazing suite of resources now. Practical resources for GPs. There's some really good ones that are written by GPs and also a document by the RSCGP, which is a bit dense, I have to say, but there's a couple of really good ones, and I've actually put some of the best ones on the teaching plan that I've also developed to go in conjunction with this talk. So I would encourage you to have a look at that as well. It's really important to be clear with your registrars about what the NDIS is for, because I do examining for the college, and every year with the exam and like with the clinical exam, registrars try to tell me that they would get the NDIS for a person at the age of 65 or someone who's palliative or someone that's just out of hospital and having rehab, and that's not at all what the NDIS is for. So it's really important to have that discussion with them. For things about home modifications, personal care assistance, behavior supports, sex therapy, because there was a case that was won by a lady in Territory, I want to say, where she was able to get her sex therapy funded through the NDIS. There were a couple of very outspoken politicians that seemed to think that disabled people are asexual or don't wish to have a normal, healthy sex life, and so were railing against it. But it is very legitimate to apply for the NDIS. The NDIS will not fund sex workers. That's a totally different thing. They won't cover anything that they think could be covered by a hospital program, a GP management plan, by palliative care services, anything like that. It's not for people over the age of 65. Once a person on the NDIS turns 65, they are offered to switch to My Age Care. And I would say 100% do not let them. They receive much more funding on the NDIS than through My Age Care. Some of the terminology, like, so often it's like, what do I suggest the patient apply for? Like, what do I do? So you've already talked to them about their level of function, and then group supports. So core things are for your patient to complete their ADLs or work towards goals and meet objectives. And that's one of the big things. Like, what do they want to do? Do they want to be able to live independently one day? Do they want to be able to get a job? Do they want to be able to communicate better so that they can go independently to the shops? So it's all about finding out what their goals are for the plan. Capital things are big investment stuff like assistance technology, equipment, you know, new wheelchair, home vehicle modifications, anything like that. But the NDIS will try and push back. So there was a young person that really had a job that was an hour and a half bus public transport right away. She wanted to get her car modified so that she could drive herself to and from work, and it was rejected because they went, oh, you can catch public transport. They were obviously appealing that decision because it's about building their future and being able to meet those goals. And if you're spending 3 hours on public transport when you could be more independent in a car, those are the sorts of things that the NDIS is supposed to be for. And then things like capacity building, so things that support them to build their independence and skills. So we're talking about training programs to build confidence, to make them work ready, to communication skills, or skills to self-manage money, cooking, you know, all those kinds of things. So that's kind of how things are grouped. And a couple of just tips. So if you get your patient to nominate you as their lead health professional, you still won't get the report. You still won't see what's happened, but it does facilitate communication a little bit. And so if there are other therapists involved, you can ring and talk to them and they can look at the plan and go, oh yeah, I see that you're also part of this plan. And as I've said, you've got to be really, really clear in reports, like, how does the patient's condition affect their functional ability? Because they will reject things that look like they're medical. So you can have a patient that's got cystic fibrosis, that's got very severe lung restriction, needs additional support because it's quite disabling. But I have seen those rejected because they go, oh, it's a medical condition. But what needs to happen in the document, you need to document how their medical condition is affecting their function and what supports they need in order to meet their ADLs, reach their goals, all that kind of thing. So that's often where the problem is. People go, oh, they're missing a leg, so therefore they should qualify. It's not about that. It's about how their disability affects that function. And tell a patient to be specific and think broadly. So my brother has an electric wheelchair, and measuring and fitting and his new electric wheelchair cost about $30,000. And then if you've got an electric wheelchair or you've got an electric bed or specialised hospital bed or anything like that, you need to build in things like maintenance to those technologies or those electric things, because that in itself can be very, very expensive. So that's just another little trick that you've got to think about, particularly for this kind of technology, that kind of capital stuff. And how do you provide evidence? Like I said, you've got to look at their impact, the severity, their capacity, the expected duration, what do they need to manage their disability, and how quickly they're deteriorating if you think they're deteriorating. So you don't have to do it yourself. You can attach medical reports from specialists, allied health summaries, and all that kind of thing. But this is the sort of stuff that needs to be included in the document. And if it's done well, it can lead to the difference between a patient getting $20,000 worth of funding and them getting $80,000 worth of funding. So it is worth taking the time to really map this out with the patient. So it's inclusionmelbourne.org.au, and it's a big document, but you tick the areas that you're applying for the NDIS, and then it's got all the box built things in, and it looks at functional impact and all that kind of stuff. So this is quite a good thing to have a look at. And then obviously on the NDIS website, they've got the evidence of psychosocial disability form. So if that's kind of the main disability, that might be the most useful one for you to complete. But this writing for the NDIS document on the NDIS website, that page that I was telling you about before, is probably one of the most useful, because it talks about how you can translate your medical speak into writing for the NDIS. So, well, this patient has had a CBA. Well, they've got an acquired brain injury. And instead of just listing off all the technical things, you know, well, it's resulted in permanent cognitive communication impairment. And he has difficulty with comprehension, verbal communication, and his social functioning is impaired. So see how that's looking very much at function. The aim is to describe how that limits his activity. So this permanent impairment is severely limiting John's ability to have conversations with his children. And then thinking about their participation. So it's severely impacting his functional capacity to fill his role as a father in the way he did pre-injury. He requires support from a speech pathologist to maintain the gains he's made from rehab. So you can apply for maintenance or improvement post-rehab, but not rehab. And his goal is to be a good dad to his children, and the speech can help maintain and improve his level of functioning and communication. So NDIS coordinators are people that can do this, that have that time to spend. But I guess it's about preparing your patient for what they should be thinking about, because it's better if they go into those meetings with the coordinators actually thinking about what they're going to need and what their goals are, because if they've got a clear idea and that, again, it leads to higher levels of funding that they can get allocated. And certainly the support letters that you write as a GP do need to include all of this language. There's two documents. There's a really good one that's like NDIS for GPs and health professionals. That would be my starting document. It clearly spells out the ages and the requirement and that common stuff. And the second one is writing for the NDIS. It's a great document. It goes through how you're supposed to write reports, the role of GP, all that. So they're all on the NDIS page under the health professionals. There's a GPs and health professionals section. In the teaching plan, I've included those as well, those links. So the NDIS does not fund medical consultations or investigations. It's the same as when you're trying to get someone diagnosed for autism. There is often an outlay of money for patients. You can use a team care arrangement, any GP management plan. You can use those to get allied health assessments and things like that. But there is always going to be an outlay of money initially for patients to get assessments and things like that. Obviously, if someone's got an established disability, you don't need to get all that stuff again. But it might be useful if you're thinking about function to get an OT assessment, to get them to look at their kind of function and what might be useful in terms of technology or resources and things like that. So that's something to think about. So it doesn't fund anything that could be like funded through Medicare, basically. So the NDIS is hard. I understand that. But it's just paperwork, and it can have really life-changing outcomes for some people. So, you know, it is worth the time to provide that education to patients. So this is a real case example, but I've modified it slightly. So this is actually my brother. My brother has, or I'll tell you more about his history as we go through. this is mostly everything that's happened in the last 2 years within this case, but I've modified it slightly to pretend like this is you and your registrar and this patient presenting to your practice. So Harry's a new patient to your practice. He presents with a carer from his new group home. So Harry has just moved from a government managed large group home facility, which was closed as a result of the NDIS, and moved into a much smaller group home in the community. So the carer presents with this patient. He's hoping that the registrar is going to be Harry's GP because it's really easy to get in to see them today. So that would be really helpful if we need an emergency. And then the carer says, oh, do you think that you might consider doing home visits to our group home? Because it might be really, it would be so much easier if you could come to us rather than us bring our patients that are in these big wheelchairs. So your registrar is very stressed about this. And so they decide to have a break and come and knock on your door to talk to you about it. So what are you going to tell your registrar? So what's their level of function like? What can they do for themselves? We talked about communication. Yeah, their past medical history. There's things about some people with cerebral palsy will have a communication board and they can use their hands in order to communicate, or they've got technology or an iPad even. So medications, things about the carer, all that sort of stuff. Is family involved still with this patient? Who makes medical decisions? Does the patient, is the guardian involved? Who makes the financial decisions? Where is the new home? What's it like? Who is looking after them? So I think you could say to your registrar, look, why don't you just start with a systems review? Go head to toe, ask about each system, find out about their medical history. What's their chest like? What are their limbs like, their bones? What's their level of function? Find out how they eat and their risk as part of that risk of aspiration. Thinking about multiple different areas, their continence. Do they have suffer from constipation? What happens to their urinary tract? I think it's really important that these patients do need a lot of time for that first consult, and you do need a full systems review to find out exactly what's been going on. And that can be really, really hard depending on who the carer is that's come with them and what information they've brought, and if they know the patient really well, particularly if they're in a group home, because sometimes you'll get someone like, oh no, I'm just a casual, I just was asked to bring them in, and that's so unhelpful. And you might need to get on the phone to the group home or to wherever they will find a carer that if the patient can't communicate for themselves. But things that are commonly forgotten are things like mental health, social supports, outings, pain management, bone and joint health is a really big problem with people with cerebral palsy or anyone confined to a wheelchair. Dental is another really big thing. It's really hard to get community dentist appointments. So that one often is a big problem. Preventative health, really underdone in general practice for people with disabilities. Communication, nutritional assessment, bowels, and don't forget sex and relationships. We already talked about this. People with disabilities are not asexual and often will aspire to being able to have a relationship. So it's important to always ask. Things like in their history, when was the last home medication review done? Hearing vision assessments, their epilepsy plan, pain management, other outside supports equipment, who's a carer, as we talked about. So I know that is an awful lot and you can't do all that in one day. So it's really important that if this is a 15-minute kind of meet and greet appointment, that the registrar says, okay, well, clearly I'm going to get a really long appointment to make sure that I assess you properly. So can we get you back, or can you send me some documents? I can have a look through and get you back for a long consult. Obviously, you kind of have to deal with the immediate issue, but building that the regular review and follow up and actually planning that time to get all that proper initial assessment stuff done is really important, because often they deal with the immediate problem on the day and then you go, oh, I'll get them back. And then you kind of miss doing all that full assessment stuff. It gets lost. So it's really important to try and encourage your registrar to be booking a really good long appointment next week, or and maybe even follow up after that. So more history. So the registrar gets this. He's a 46-year-old man. He's got severe cerebral palsy with left hemiparesis and severe epilepsy. He has daily seizures, but they're mostly managed, but they do make him a little bit drowsy after he has them. He mobilizes in a motorized wheelchair, but a carer needs to use that. He can't use that himself. He looks pretty thin just looking at him. He isn't able to communicate effectively. There's a question about his vision and hearing, but certainly the family report that he's very aware when they're visiting, and he does vocalize when he's really happy, and he definitely displays emotion. So he was hospitalized 2 years ago with severe aspiration pneumonia. He had a peg that was inserted 2 months ago, and he had aspiration pneumonia post-op from the peg and the peg. But now he's actually been eating quite well since he's been moved to the group home. And one of the factors of that is that all the food is prepared on site by the carers. And so you get that additional sensory input, I guess, from food being cooked around you and the smells and that anticipation about what the food might be like and the different taste. So certainly oral intake has been improving since the PEG was put in. It's mainly used for medications now and for giving fluids if he's unwell. He's on a full thick fluid, so that's pudding consistency, and he's on a pureed diet because of his aspiration risk. And his past medical history includes Dandy Walker syndrome. He's got osteoporosis, scoliosis. He gets regular constipation, which is managed with regular enemas or suppositories, sorry. He's got double incontinence, but most of the concern has been on prevention of pressure areas. He's got a brand new wheelchair that costs 30 grand, and he's recently moved into this group home. So he lives with four other residents. He has regular outings at the support agency under the NDIS, and that's my brother visiting the Anzac Bridge walk at Newcastle, which is beautiful if you ever visit. But he requires intensive support for all his ADLs. His family are involved and they make medical decisions, but the guardian is involved for financial decisions. So I think that is a really good distinction to make, and who is actually responsible for making decisions. So in terms of cerebral palsy, I think it's good to just remind yourself of the sorts of things that can be affected with someone's got cerebral palsy. It obviously affects different parts of the body. And so if you've ever watched the Paralympic Games, there are multiple categories for people with cerebral palsy, because you can have someone that has one kind of upper arm, a small part of their arm affected, and you can have someone that has quite severe hemiplegia or quadriplegia from their cerebral palsy. So, and I think it's important, one in three is unable to walk, so we'll be using a wheelchair. One in four is unable to talk. Pain is a big issue. So three out of four will experience pain, and that's really underdiagnosed and poorly managed. Epilepsy is common. Intellectual impairment can be common. Bladder control, sleep, and saliva tends to be. These are the sorts of common things that occur with people with cerebral palsy. So already you're looking across multiple systems, and that, you know, can get really overwhelming, but you don't need to address all these things at once. So your registrar decided to take the group home on with your support, and certainly we've had a couple of registrars do that, with support from their supervisor. And I think it's really important if you've got a keen registrar, it's good input to support that. But it's also important if a registrar feels completely overwhelmed and just doesn't want to, that they don't feel kind of pressured into it either, because they'll just get really stressed and the patient care is probably not going to be done well either. So it's good to support them through that. But certainly looking after a group home can be really, really rewarding. So in this circumstance, your registrar calls you from the group home. They just have gone down for their regular weekly review of the patient, and Harry's been refusing food for the last 24 hours, and he seems unhappier than usual according to staff. Your registrar says, I don't really know him that well, he doesn't really seem that different to me. But the registrar's going, oh gosh, what do I do? I don't know what to do. I've just done all the assessments and he's been well, but now the carers are saying that maybe he's not well, I don't know what to do. I have put a note there that the registrar in this circumstance did call the family to confirm that Harry's advanced care directive was up to date. And I include that because the number of times my parents have been called, and that's the first question from the hospital, from the GP, from anybody that's calling them. It's not, can you tell us more about the history or what might have changed? They're like, oh, I'm just ringing to double check that his advanced care directive was up to date because he's unwell. And that's really awful that that's the first thing that my parents always contacted about, because it implies that the doctor that's seeing them is like, oh well, he's going to die, so I just want to make sure that you're aware that he's probably going to die and his advanced care directive is up to date. So I include that. It sounds a bit condescending, but it's common, and my parents have been called a lot, and that's the only question they've been asked.
What's behind that, Al? Why is it an automatic default to, are they ticking a box here? I mean, that to me, that, as you say, is a really inappropriate and really potentially very hurtful thing.
It's really hurtful
to say to carers of somebody with a disability, and it seems very unthinking. I guess I'm a little bit surprised.
I guess that's it. That's the reality of what people with disabilities face. My parents have been called by interns, RMOs, a lot of like low level, but inexperienced doctors, and that's still the first thing that gets asked. So it's not just coming from registrars and specialists. So the registrar does the examination, say febrile, looks tired, maybe a bit pale, don't know. And Harry slept through all the assessment, doesn't seem to be in any obvious distress. Blood pressure's right, heart rate is, you know, a little bit up, but it's not too bad. There's no masses on abdomen, but he was examined in the wheelchair. So I think that's really important to think of. So there's a question about his urine being more smelly, slightly loose, there's no issues with skin integrity. palpation, chest clear. I think registrars get really overwhelmed by what to do on examination when someone's in a wheelchair and got quite significant perhaps deformity or spasticity of their limbs. And it's about just being simple. Like, you can listen to the front of the chest, you can listen to their heart, you can listen to their lungs at the front of the chest. You can do a blood pressure, you can do a heart rate, you can feel their pulse. You can palpate all their limbs and feel for any pain. A very major fracture can occur from very minor trauma, particularly in someone with cerebral palsy where their bone density might be really poor. So physically palpating the limbs, checking as much the systems, looking in their mouth, so it's common about looking in their mouth, all those sorts of things. If you can encourage them to simplify it, go, well, what can we do? If he's in the group home, they lift him up into the bed and you can do a proper abdominal examination, which you probably can't do in your own practice if you don't have a lifter. So there's things like that, looking for skin integrity, pressure areas, all that kind of thing. What do you recommend to your registrar do at this point? Transfer to hospital. That's always the default mode. And I would encourage you not to make that the first thing you consider, just because this patient is going to end up in ED and they're going to send them straight back up, because I've seen it happen. So if you can do some work with it, they don't appear to be in significant distress, see what you can do in practice. And the idea of the group home not being the best place, sometimes it actually is, because if it's like going to a nursing home, like there's often a nurse on site, they will have temperature, blood pressure, cough, all those kinds of things. In most circumstances, you might be able to get them onto the bed more easily to look them, get the staff to help you roll them over, look for pressure areas, all that kind of thing. So it's about assessing what the group home's like and what help they might have in there. Let's assume that you ask this registrar, they had a COVID swab. Yep, COVID negative. Excellent. Great. They decided to take some bloods because they just kind of, oh, they're pretty pale. Like, I don't have any baseline blood, so let's do some baseline bloods. And actually, his hemoglobin is 72, a CRP of 200 and white blood cells of 16. The urine was positive for strep, so your registrar was really diligent, started them on antibiotics after they tried to get a urine collection. But it's really important. I know everyone's worried about, God, this is sepsis, but it's just good to come back to basics, like listen to their chest. No, they don't have pneumonia. Have they got a fever? No, they don't have a fever. Having said that, though, some people with disabilities may not present classically with a fever and sepsis, so I will definitely say that to you. But it's about thinking logically through the problem, thinking about your differential list. So what they look like there. So someone that's very sick will look really sick and you can get them to hospital, but you kind of need like a backup, like reason for why you're sending them. So your discussion with you and your registrar, you decide, look, he's got hemoglobin 70, we can't manage this in the group home, let's call an ambulance. Now, true story, this ambulance took 8 hours to come and collect my brother from the group home and take him to hospital. So don't assume that calling an ambulance is going to actually lead to fast care, useful care, because that was where he was prioritised. So even though my brother has the most amazing, wonderful GP, who's a friend and a colleague of mine who was involved in all of this, she organised the ambulance, you know, hand over everything. They still prioritise him very low, 8 hours before they send an ambulance. So that's why I'm saying sending him to hospital might not be the best, unless you can really back it up that, yes, this person's really sick, we need to get him there ASAP. So in hospital, 2 units of blood, IV antibiotics and fluids. They went, oh, he's probably got urosepsis, and they sent him home, even though he's had a hemoglobin of 70, which that's a pretty massive drop to have urosepsis. And they sent him home. So now what? They had took up some follow-up bloods. The CRP is still 100. Your registrar went, I think we'll do an ultrasound. Like, this is just really weird. We'll do an ultrasound because it's really hard to get a CT. So let's do an ultrasound. And they had to refer to the hospital to do this. So again, you've got to think about where I can refer this patient, how easy is it to access that, all that kind of stuff. But it turned out I had a 2-centimeter renal stone. And basically the kidney had zero parenchyma left. And the registrar said, oh gosh, called the urology reg, admitted back to hospital. So back in hospital, so there was about 2-3 months gap between that hospital admission where he got the bloods and this hospital admission where the stone was identified. My brother didn't get better, but he wasn't sick enough to be in hospital. He sort of seemed happy, was sort of eating, but he just wasn't right. And that's why they continued to do investigations. And that's how long it took to organise ultrasound, follow up bloods, all that kind of thing. So things just take a lot longer in the community. And that's why I have to admit I was very angry that he didn't get any investigations in hospital. It's so much easier to access that stuff. So they put in some stents. they thought the kidney stone had been there for years, and the neurologist said he needed to have a kidney resection, and he was discharged back to the group home 2 days later, no pain relief. So again, really common thing, people with disabilities don't get good pain management, people that can't communicate don't get good pain management, so it's important to be thinking about that. So this is very recent. This month has had a right kidney resection that went very smoothly in hospital. Even though he'd had a massive open resection of his kidney, he was clearly didn't have as much pain and wasn't feeling as unwell from the stone. And there was a lot of liaison between the staff, us, and the carers of the group home before they sent him home. He had a really good management plan for wound, pain relief, and follow-up. And that was something that we had a lot of involvement making sure that got happened. But your wonderful registrar recommended that they do staff do a temperature check every 4 hours on discharge, and he spiked a fever 6 after surgery and went back to hospital, and he was given antibiotics and discharged back. So, but he's back home now and doing really well. And I have to point out that that was the very first time that my brother had ever had a fever in all of this process and all the previous UTIs and everything that he had, but the potential urosepsis, everything. He never actually spiked a fever. So I think that's really important to be aware that some people with disabilities look a lot better or a lot more well than they potentially are. So these are the teaching points that I think it's important to talk about with your registrars. And one is about keeping an open mind, that whatever is going on, it's probably not their disability. People with disabilities get other medical conditions. I had a registrar tell me about one of their patients that has Down syndrome who had very severe abdominal rigidity and was a lot of abdominal stuff going on and bleeding from the bowel, all sorts of things, you know, referred to hospital, but he's a patient that always looks happy and always looks well. And so in ED, they went, oh, he looks too well to be that sick, and discharged straight away without doing any investigation. So I think that it's important to encourage your registrar to think broadly, like, could that be an underlying medical issue that's going on for this patient, particularly with behavioural change? A new behaviour change is probably not their disability. I've seen a number of cases of young people with severe behaviour change, aggression, when it's turned out that actually they had meningitis or something really serious going on, and the only way that they could communicate that was to have significant behaviour change and aggression. So I think it's really important for registrars, probably not their disability. And looks can be deceiving, like I've mentioned. And I think it's really important to encourage a registrar to check their bias. So is there something stopping them from seeing the bigger picture or an alternative diagnosis for this patient? Are they just being so overwhelmed by what they're seeing with the patient and with the disability that they're not actually thinking about just general medical issues that could be going on? And I think it's really easy to just have that premature closure and go, oh, it's probably this, and not think broadly. And that happens really commonly in disability. And then thinking about access issues. So how can you get bloods? Like, does the registrar have to go and try and get blood themselves? Or is there someone that can go in into the group home or go to the person's home and get it? Because access is such a big issue for patients getting from their home to healthcare, to pathology, to all these places. It's really hard. And imaging. So they might not be able to refer to your local imaging place because they don't have the facilities to get this patient up and into the bed. So that might have to be through the hospital. And facilitating that with the referral, making it really clear on the written referral, like what's going to be required for this patient. And also, particularly if there's guardianship involvement for medical decisions or family consent, so that making sure there's some sort of consent for any invasive medical procedures, particularly if you want contrast, IV contrast, anything like that, like just making sure you've crossed them in. And has the registrar done an appropriate examination? And thinking about those ways to break down, make it easy with the registrar. So that's the important points that I'd like to pull out of that case. I wanted to talk about a few other common concerns that often come up for patients that have got disabilities, particularly intellectual disabilities, where they might be a lot more functional coming in with a carer, might be doing a lot more things in the community. And so these are some of the common things that come up. Now, I really want to give a big plug for preventative health. So other than disability care as one of my passion areas, preventative health is another one. Preventative health is really, really important. It rarely occurs in disability care. And again, it's because often these patients present to us and we're dealing with the most acute issue. They're not often coming in for regular follow-up or that once a month checkup and that preventative care. So I really, really want to push for you to be discussing this with not just patients with disability, but with all patients, particularly people with intellectual disabilities. They really have high rates of preventable disease and early death. And a lot of that is due to diabetes, hypertension, obesity, and dyslipidemia. And these things are very preventable. And I encourage you doing this sort of thing and scheduling regular appointments. I'm encouraging the registrar to schedule regular appointments with their patients to be discussing these sorts of things. There are particular genetic causes of intellectual disability that can alter their cardiometabolic profile. So particularly Down syndrome that increases their risk of diabetes, obesity, dyslipidemia. But you also have in Down syndrome increased risk of leukemias and things like that as well. So having a regular schedule of preventive health, touching base with patients with Down syndrome, because to be honest, that's probably the most common patient that you're going to see. It's the most common intellectual disability in Australia. And you will see patients on very broad spectrum. You'll see patients that are very independent, and certainly you've got some incredible high profile people in Australia who have got Down syndrome. We've got actors, we've got athletes, and we've got models. So you've got people that are very high functioning. And then you can have the other end of the spectrum where you do have people with Down syndrome that have a lot lower levels of function. So this very broad spectrum can exist. So it's important not to pigeonhole those patients, because some will definitely have the ability to consent for lots of things, if not everything, and others will not. So having that discussion with patients doing assessments is important. There's some others, and I've certainly seen cases of Prader-Willi syndrome. And if you haven't seen a case of that, those patients often have that first 12 months after they're born. They're very difficult feeders, underweight, really hard to gain weight, really slow growth. And then there's like a switch that flicks in their brain and they just become this very strong appetite drive. So obesity and dyslipidemia is very, very common in those patients. And it can be very, very difficult for families of those patients because cupboards need to be locked. They just are almost kind of ravenous. There's this such strong drive to eat that is driven in signals from their brain. They're the main cases that I've seen, but a lot of patients with intellectual disability will often have higher rates of things like obesity and diabetes and dyslipidemia. So then incredible fact sheets and information that's been put together from the University of New South Wales. I can't encourage you enough to go and have a look at their website. They have this incredible group of information for GPs about how you can look at prevention of disease for your patients with intellectual disabilities. And I'm going to talk about it in a moment, but they also have this incredible series of podcasts on YouTube about how to prescribe medications for behavioural issues for those with intellectual disabilities. And that podcast series is excellent. I encourage you enough to go and have a look at that. So it's important to talk about what activity are you doing, what's happening with diet and lifestyle. We should be doing waist circumference, checking height, weight, looking at what's happening at home, what is the access. As part of the NDIS, the patients can access exercise as one of the supports. There's dance classes and exercise physiology and all sorts of things that they can access as part of that if that is deemed necessary to continue to improve their function, particularly things like strength exercise and that kind of thing. But we should be doing regular blood pressure checks, checking their kidney function, checking their glucose, checking their lipid profiles, all those sorts of things. There is also another great resource from Queensland about gradual desensitization for venipuncture as well that I would encourage you to have a look for, because that might help for other patients as well. Now, obviously, we don't want to be doing blood tests on patients without reason, but it's important to be thinking about these sorts of things. And also thinking about medications and the effect that their medication might be having on their obesity or appetite, all those sorts of things. So their big thing is don't just screen for this stuff, intervene. And I think that's a great, great line for our patients as well, and to be talking about the registrars. Don't just screen for this stuff, like do something about it as well. I really encourage you to have a look at their website, 3DN, UNSW. They have got some great resources as well. There's also some great healthcare checklists that are from a Australian Journal of General Practice article from a couple of years ago, looking at healthcare checklists for adults with developmental disabilities, but also Royal Children's Hospital has a great Down screening table. So, you know, the things that we should be doing yearly, getting a yearly blood pressure check, checking gums and teeth. It's really hard to access dental services in the community for patients, but there are community-free dental services that can be accessed. You just need to make sure you and your registrar know how to access those. There is often a long wait for that, which can be a problem for a lot of patients. Do you need to do a regular hearing assessment, checking eyes, what about vision, medication reviews, all those sorts of things. And the Royal Children's Hospital Down syndrome assessments. And so it talks about if you've got a young new bub that's been born, what things need to happen over the next between now and them becoming an adult. ENT assessments, looking at their constipation, their GI tract, you know, their diet, an annual full blood count, and also TSH. You know, so these sorts of assessments are really important to be thinking about for these patients, and often they're missed. Preventative health is a big, big thing, and I really encourage you to be discussing that with your registrars, because, like I said before, it's not just patients with disability, although we're rarely talked about with patients with disability, but for all of our patients. So bone health. It's important to talk about your registrars, particularly patients that are in a wheelchair or who have cerebral palsy or low muscle tone, thinking about doing a DEXA scan with body composition if one's never been done before. Now, unfortunately, that's not Medicare available for people with disability, which I think is, you know, a bit shocking, to be honest. But particularly for someone that's always been in a wheelchair or got severe cerebral palsy, anything like that, I think it's important. If a DEXA's never been done and they're an adult, it's probably worthwhile, particularly if they're not on any bisphosphonates or not on any medication to be preventing them from having a fracture. So one of my patients in the past, I was looking through the history and I said, oh, you broke your femur. Now, this is a patient that was in a wheelchair. I said, oh, how did that happen? And he said that he was lying in bed and the carers were moving him on a slide sheet from across the bed, and his foot got caught in the slide sheet and twisted slightly and his femur snapped. Now, he had severely low bone density, but that had never been picked up. So he had a very, very, very low minimal trauma fracture, and a very severe fracture as well, a femur, from something very, very simple. So that patient was then not put onto long-term bisphosphonates, but you want to prevent these things from happening. So the other preventative things that can be done, so checking their vitamin D status, calcium, phosphate, and their thyroid and parathyroid, and plus or minus testosterone if it's clinically relevant. And then doing some kind of nutritional assessment, like, are they getting enough vitamin D? Often patients with disabilities or in wheelchairs don't get enough sunlight, so they may not be getting a lot of vitamin D, so that might need to be supplemented. And certainly we've seen in older patients that regular vitamin D supplementation can help with maintaining muscle mass as well and balance. So regular vitamin D supplementation might actually be very appropriate. And checking, are they getting enough calcium in their diet? Are they getting a broad range of foods? Are they getting meeting all their nutritional needs? And you might not be able to do all of that. That might be a dietitian review. So are they getting any kind of weight-bearing exercise? That can be really hard for patients that are in a wheelchair or who have para quadriplegia or have severe cerebral palsy. But there is exercise that can be done. They can might be able to go to the pool. There are specialist exercise physiologists and gym people that can create exercise programs. There's wheelchair dance classes, all sorts of things that it just might not have been discussed with the carer before or with the patient, that these options exist. Now, those options may not exist for you if you're based out in a rural area, but there's always a way. It's about coming up with solutions. That's what's so great about this area of medicine. It's not seeing things as always being a problem or unachievable. It's working out a great solution with the patient. And that's why I think that's why my brain really loves working in this area of medicine. Then considering, does there need to be specialist management with a rheumatologist review? If they've got a high risk, they've had a minimal trauma fracture, then absolutely they're going to need rheumatologist assessment. And before commencing on any kind of bisphosphonates long-term, I think you really need to have that DEXA scan. You need to talk to the rheumatologist to talk about the best option, because these patients might be quite young. They might be in their 20s and have low bone density. Are they going to be on bisphosphonates for the next 30, 40 years? So this is a discussion that needs to happen with the rheumatologist about the best option for this patient. And then you need to be try to correcting all of the other stuff that's out there. So bone health. So again, part of preventative medicine, but bone health is a really, really important thing to consider for people with any kind of disability. Now, sexual and reproductive health, again, another area of preventive medicine. So all young people need sex education. I think disabled people are often seen as asexual, that they don't need sex, but often they have the same sexual needs as the rest of us, as everybody in society. But may have not the access or the support, or people may not have ever asked them that question. So there are specialist sex therapists that can help, particularly people that are in wheelchairs, to help with sexual function. But I think the discussion needs to be had. So there's this beautiful, beautiful story that's worth Googling on. They discussed on ABC, where it was two young people who were born with Down syndrome. They were athletes for the Special Olympics. They were both very good swimmers, and they met as a part of that swimming training. And they were, I think, about 17, 18. They might have been a little bit older, but they fell in love. He absolutely adored her. They wanted to get married. They were very much talking about each other and with their families, that they wanted to have family, they wanted to have home, they wanted to build a life together. And it's worth going and having a look. I think it's on Australian Story 180. It's worth going and actually watching that, because they interview the parents and the parents are terrified by this, I think is probably the best way of putting it, because they feel like, how are we going to support these young people into the future? And so it's really important to be having these discussions with particularly patients that have got intellectual disabilities, any kind of disability, with all of our young people, talking about sex education. I mentioned that women with intellectual disabilities are at very high risk of being sexually assaulted, being involved in relationships where there's strong domestic violence. And so I think it's because of our lack of education for them when they're younger and the lack of teaching them what appropriate relationships are, and the people around them are teaching them what appropriate relationships are. Often these patients can be very vulnerable and can be put into situations. And I think it's important that we be having these conversations at a young age to prevent that if possible. And then, you know, you might be there going, oh, capacity, all these sorts of things, but all these young patients are the same as our other young patients. Having a chat with the parent or the carer and patient and then saying, oh, look, all young people, I like to have 5 minutes just to have a chat. If there's anything else that they want to ask us, the two of us, just to get used to them chatting to the doctor by themselves. And certainly if the patient is capable of doing that, then I think that's really, really important. And if they're not, like, what is it that's stopping that? Do they need access to better communication aids? Do they need a sign interpreter? Like, what do they need to be able to communicate with you? And that's what's important to be discussing with the family and the patient. But there's other things as well, like, does this patient, if they become sexually active, how are you going to organise regular cervical smears for this patient? So if they are in a wheelchair, can you get them up onto the bed to do a cervical smear, to do screening? If not, well, who's going to do that? Like, is there a service in the hospital that can do that for you? This is very, very important things, and I think it's not done well out in the community. And then thinking about family planning, contraception, and it's really important to be having those discussions with your registrar about how to assess capacity to make decisions. And that's just not for this group of patients. This is across the board. There are young 12-year-old that comes in asking to go into the pill, to our older patient who we're worried about them driving, all those things. Having that ability to assess capacity is really, really important. So another area that is worthwhile to be talking about with the registrar. So in terms of pain management, I'm going to talk about how about 3 out of 4 people with cerebral palsy experience regular pain, and that can be from a range of things. It might be musculoskeletal pain, it might be pain from the aids that they have, would be the wheelchair or the walking aid, or if they require one, it might be pain from any kind of contractures or spasticity that they might have from a long period of time, skin rubbing, pressure areas. It might be, like my brother's case, it might be kidney stone or some other kind of underlying cause of pain. But people with cerebral palsy often experience regular pain. And again, it's frequently unrecognized because it may not present in the same way. And it's important to manage appropriately, to be having those discussions, to be doing those assessments. If someone's not eating, why are they not eating? Maybe it's because they're in pain. Why are they in pain? Let's go and looking for a reason. But yeah, other psychological issues that someone might not be eating as well, there's psychological pain as well. So it's important to be trying to teach your registrar to recognise and to manage appropriately. And certainly often patients with disabilities, particularly intellectual disabilities, are very, very sensitive to side effects from medication. So it's important that if you are going to manage somebody's pain, or you think that they're in pain and you do want to manage it, but you're starting very, very low dose and going very, very slow, because they're most likely going to have significant side effects from that medication. And in talking about pain, my brother, after his initial diagnosis of that very large kidney stone, he was sent home from hospital with no pain relief. He had stents inserted into his ureters, but he was sent home with zero pain relief. And it was only that the GP came out 2 days later and went, oh gosh, he's not having pain relief, and was able to put him onto some. So often this happens. Patients are discharged home from hospital with quite severe diagnoses or illnesses or something that for anybody else would be sent home with quite significant pain relief and sent home with nothing. So it's important to be assessing that if you've got a patient that's sent home from hospital. Now, one of the big things people are often very concerned about is managing behavioural problems. So in the past, there was quite a lot of use of medication to manage behavioural problems without a lot of kind of assessment for what might have been the cause. So now any kind of medication used to treat behavioural problems is often kind of referred to as a chemical restraint. So you have to have a very, very good reason for starting any kind of psychotropic medication. For this reason, it is seen now as a kind of chemical restraint. But having said that, drugs may be appropriate if the behaviour is very persistent, it's pervasive across multiple situations, it's very frequent, and there's no underlying correctable cause that can be identified for the behaviour. And it's quite severe. It's causing distress to the patient, it's causing injury to the patient, to other people, it's compromising their health, and it's restricting their activities and their community access. So much like when we're assessing someone with bipolar syndrome and we look at reputational risk as a way of looking at the severity. Are they doing things that are likely to cause them harm, not just physical harm, but psychological harm, reputational harm? It's a bit the same. You know, is it this behaviour mean that their carer is no longer able to take them out to the community, they're no longer able to do activities that they find enjoyment in, all those kind of things. So it's really important to be documenting. And so specific questions to be considering: is the person or others at risk of injury from the behaviour? And have you assessed potential causes? So what is your hypothesis for the cause of the behaviour? And what interventions have been tried? And we're going to talk about those sorts of things. So there needs to be, in most cases, there need to be other non-medication interventions that have been tried and assessments that need to have occurred before you then are looking at any kind of medication. And does the behaviour actually warrant treatment with drugs? Is there a clear psychiatric or medical diagnosis that is going to mean that medication is going to be appropriate? Or are you just making them sleepy and quiet and yay, everyone's happy because the behaviour has stopped, but actually you just made them sleepy and quiet. You actually haven't managed the behaviour. And is there a drug that is going to help this person? So it's not a drug that's going to help this person. Maybe it's additional support or it's an assessment or it's managing the home situation. You need to be thinking about, does the benefits outweigh the harm of prescribing this drug? And then you've got to be thinking about efficacy, adverse reactions. There's a lot to be considered and a lot of assessments that need to occur before any kind of medication is prescribed. Obviously, there may be acute situations where there's a severe risk of harm to the patient or other people around the patient. But if there's been such a sudden change in behaviour where the patient has been fine and now is suddenly very, very aggressive, is probably an underlying medical cause. So I have seen a number of patients presenting with sudden behavioural change, very aggressive behaviour change, you know, big lads, big strong lads, causing quite severe harm to other people around them, brought into hospital, underlying intellectual disability, initial assessment, oh, it's probably just their intellectual disability, but actually no, there was quite significant. One had meningitis and the other one had benign swelling in the brain for some unknown reason. So these patients actually had quite severe pain and quite severe diagnosis going on, which caused this sudden change in behaviour and very aggressive behaviour. So that's why it needs to be like, is the behaviour persistent, pervasive? Has it been happening for a long time? Is it frequent? And all those things. If there's been this sudden change in behaviour, there's most likely some kind of underlying severe diagnosis that's going on or some kind of pain that's caused it. And that needs to be addressed before you're looking at any kind of chemical restraint, I guess. The podcast that I really, really encourage you to have a look at. So I've included the link. It's on the fact sheet, the GPSA teaching plan that I've done. The link for podcast series is on there. So it's called Responsible Psychotropic Prescribing to Adults with Intellectual Disability. And they also have a series focused on children and adolescents. They're really short videos, about 15 minutes. I really, really encourage you to have a look at them if you have any kind of patients that are like this. They might already be on medication or you might be considering it, because they talk about some case studies, they talk about assessments that need to occur and all those kinds of things. So I really encourage you to have a look at those. But they talk about, have all of the other things been addressed before you've got to medication? Does this patient have basic security? Are they in a safe environment? Has something happened? Is there someone at home that's causing them distress? Has there been a change in a carer? Has there been, you know, is there abuse going on? Is there another resident that's moved into the home that they're in that's very aggressive or that's causing problems? Like, what is the basic security like for this patient? Do they feel safe? And then is there a medical issue going on? And that's where all the assessments come in, things that we talked about in the first presentation. And then now, yeah, mental health. So is there a mental health reason going on? Does this person have anxiety? Do they have depression? Is there some kind of underlying psychosis that's new or that's been developing? There are some intellectual disabilities that predispose patients to developing psychosis, and so it's worthwhile exploring that, particularly if someone has a diagnosis of an intellectual disability but there's no underlying cause, then maybe a genetics review is appropriate to identify what this patient might be at risk of long term. And in those podcast case series, they do talk about a couple of those sorts of things. And now behaviour. So can the behaviour be addressed by modifications to the way who's looking after them? Can there be simple things that can be done? Is there a sensory issue going on? Is that sound? Is it light? Is there something that can be addressed that might actually reduce this person's distress level? And then we get to medication. So often it takes a long while to work out what's going on with these patients and then to be thinking about medication. So it's very much the last resort. So tips for choosing appropriate medications. So what are you treating? And I think it's really important you need to come up with a diagnosis. Are you just treating the fact that the carers don't know how to manage the patient anymore, that the carers are burnt out? Maybe there's actually, it's a carer issue and you need to provide some support to the carer and then actually things might settle down. So what are you treating? Does the patient have a diagnosable condition? Is there anxiety, depression? Is there psychosis? Is there something that you can treat? Like, what are the issues? And so if you don't know what you're treating, what other assessments do you need to do? You probably need to do a medical assessment. And there's a great guideline for an assessment summary. They've got 10 domains that they encourage you to be assessing before you start looking at starting medication. And again, that is on that 3DM website. And I encourage you to have a look at that. That's developed from Children's Hospital at Westmead. So it's more tone of focus on kids, but I still think it's extremely relevant. So what medical assessments do you need to do? Do you need to find an underlying medical issue, particularly if there is this is new? Do you need to organise for an OT assessment to look at sensory issues for this patient, particularly if this, maybe they've got intellectual disability, but maybe there's kind of an undiagnosed autism or something kind of sensory condition that's going on as well. And if you can identify that, then you can modify things at home to actually reduce the level of distress. Psychologist review, like, are there any behavioural interventions? Are there some psychological assessments or interventions that can be put in place that might reduce the behaviours or improve things as well? Or some things taught to the carers that they can help manage this better? I put dietitian in there because does this patient already have a metabolic syndrome, diabetes, obesity, dyslipidemia, anything like that? And then you're thinking about starting a medication which may worsen that. So you might need to look at getting a dietitian review. And then if you're unsure about your diagnosis, you've ruled all of this stuff out, you think maybe there's a psychosis going on, you're just not quite sure, maybe you need to organise for a psychiatrist assessment. And there are specialist people for all of those that just work with people with intellectual disabilities or for other disabilities that might be appropriate. So it's worthwhile ringing around or talking to your local psychologist, particularly if you're in a small town, to talk to psychologists or your local psychiatrist about who might be the best person to see this patient, thinking about your assessments. Now, what are the potential side effects of the medication now you're considering? So it might actually be that something's happened and actually this patient you think might be a bit depressed or has got anxiety that is suddenly worsened from maybe there was a particular reason their anxiety is worsened, but now that anxiety is causing them to act out, unable to go out to the community, all those kinds of things. So for anxiety, depression, for people with intellectual disabilities, and looking at SSRIs, it's your first line. But there are other side effects for other medications, and particularly patients with intellectual disabilities, they're most likely going to have side effects. If anyone's going to get a side effect from medication, they're going to get the side effect. So it's really important to be thinking about those medications. And in those podcasts, the YouTube videos, they do talk about patients that were put on olanzapine and risperidone for behavioural issues who developed very, very severe side effects. So they're exquisitely sensitive to psychotropic drugs, and any kind of side effects are more likely to be prolonged after you stop medication or semi-permanent. So you just don't want to do that to the patient, for them developing very severe side effects that are unlikely to go away because of the medication you started. So that's why it's really, really important to avoid psychotropic medications if you can at all costs because of the side effects. But SSRIs might be more appropriate. And again, very low dose, go slow. So start low and go slow with these patients. So best practice guidelines are really important. And then you need to be considering method of delivery for this patient as well. So if they've got swallowing issues, whether it needs to be liquid or via PEG, depot medications are not recommended because for patients with intellectual disability, depot medications, they're more likely to get the severe side effects from depot medications than from other medications. So that's really important to be thinking about the method of delivery And then how are you going to monitor this? So if this is a patient that doesn't like having blood tests, that refuses them, all those kinds of things, and you're going to put them on a medication that needs to be monitored really closely, well, that's just not going to work. So again, you need to be thinking about big picture for this patient. So these are the tips that I really, really suggest. And going back to this slide, there's a lot that needs to happen before you get to medication. And if you're still going, oh gosh, like I do have a patient that maybe it is worthwhile, I really, really encourage you to go and watch those videos because, like I said, there's about four, they're 15-minute videos. They present a case study. They talk about the assessments and, that are done previously, and they talk about monitoring and potential side effects. So I really encourage you to go and have a look at those for more information. So suspected abuse, this is one of the hardest things, I think, for registrars, for all of us, is working out if you think a patient might be subjected to abuse at home or in their care facility and how you can identify that and what can you do. Like Anne-Marie Smith died last year, actually might have been the year before now, of severe septic shock. She had multi-organ failure. She had severe pressure sores, malnutrition, and she had other significant medical issues related to her cerebral palsy. The coroner determined that it was likely that she had been left in a cane chair up to 24 hours a day in her own home for more than a year. Now, that carer has been charged with manslaughter. That's all before the courts now. But I think it is a broader failing for us as a society that a person with a disability can suffer so much and us not know. This was a woman that should have had all the luxury and the supports that she needed after her parents passed away. So her parents had enough money. When they passed away, they left it to her. They organised that there was enough money. She had a home to live in. She had NDIS supports in place, carers coming in. She had her own home and they expected that she would be able to continue to do her normal things, her normal activities and be well cared for after they passed away. But unfortunately, she was trapped in this very abusive situation, carers that stole from her, that mistreated her. She was unable to access the help that she required or to have voice to be able to access. I think it's an extremely, extremely distressing situation, and for someone to be in that situation is just awful. But again, it's that Swiss cheese effect. Lots of things like why the medical practice, they hadn't seen her for 12 months. Why haven't they seen her? Your family, were their family not checking up on her? Neighbours, just lots of us that are fortunately complicit in, unassumingly so, our most vulnerable members of society not being well looked after. So what can we be doing about this? So I guess for your patients that come into your practice that have quite severe disabilities, that are vulnerable, and this is across the board, it's important to be seeing them regularly. And then if they're not showing up for appointments, be following up as much as you can. If you suspect that abuse is happening from a carer, from a group home, all those kinds of things, and that's thinking about, is this injury lining up with what happened? Has it been a sudden behavioural change? And certainly we've seen that with the Royal Commission, quite severe documented evidence of people with disabilities being abused in group homes and all kinds of things. So it definitely happens. So who can help? So if you think that you've got strong concerns about an NDIS provider, whether that be carers or support people or whoever, the NDIS Quality and Safeguards Commission can be contacted on that number, and they've got an online complaints as well. So that's if you're making a complaint, or if you talk about the patient or the carers, if they want to make a complaint about an NDIS provider, that's what they can do. If you've got significant concerns about abuse or neglect that's happening, so there is a National Disability Abuse and Neglect Hotline. To be honest, I don't actually know what they do, because when you read what it says, they say that the hotline works with callers to find appropriate ways of dealing with reports of abuse or neglect through referral, information and support. The hotline remains impartial, does not take sides and does not advocate on anyone's behalf. So I think they're only there to provide information, is my understanding, and I have spoken to them in the past and basically about what can you do? And so basically they give advice about where to go from then on. But again, they're not going to advocate for anyone. They're not going to come charging in and kind of do an assessment or anything like that, but they will give advice. So I think if you've got strong concerns that a person with disability might be experiencing abuse or neglect, probably talk to your MDO, and then you can talk to this National Disability Abuse and Neglect Hotline and get some advice. If you've got immediate concerns about violence or crime about this patient, well, then obviously you need to call the police. Again, talk to your MDO, and then you need to talk to the police if you think that this person is suffering severe abuse or neglect that needs to be addressed right now. Unfortunately, it's not great, the supports that are there. It's really hard to assess, particularly if patients are non-verbal or have difficulty communicating. It is really hard, but I hope that at least I've given you a few avenues if you do have any concerns about that, where you might be able to go to for advice or help. So to finish, all of this we've talked about requiring lots of assessments, lots of time. A lot of these patients are not going to be able to pay privately for all of the effort and the time that you're putting in. And unfortunately, it's just tough. We are GPs. Most of us came into general practice because we love the idea of being in a community and being seeing the whole families, being able to treat someone from a holistic perspective. And this is why in most cases we privately bill patients that can afford. It's so that we can look after these patients that can't afford to pay privately. But there are some billing tips that I can give you. Per year, your patients can have a GP management plan. They can do a team care arrangement as well. And then you can also have a team care reviews. So there's money right there you're getting for particular appointments. A yearly health assessment can be done for patients with intellectual disability. So you can do that as well. And you might use that assessment to be looking particularly for behavioural issues, how that's being managed, any kind of support, social supports, those kinds of things. And then looking at particular aspects related to their disability. You can do a home medicines review as well. And then, you know, you're looking at, they're probably going to need, for most patients, I would recommend once a month, particularly if they're quite complex, because then if you could just say, let's do it once a month and do a long appointment, you can be doing this preventative stuff with patients throughout the year. So you don't need to do all of these things at once. And now it is your registrar. So there's more money there. There's bulk billing incentives that I'm pretty sure still existing. I know that they have reduced those particular areas. There's case conference that you might be able to do too. So a case conference with provider, particularly might be a carer in the group home, and might be with psychiatrist or psychologist or with OT. So, you know, particularly for behavioural issues, maybe a case conference would actually be really beneficial, having OT do their assessment as part of, you know, team care arrangement. And then you're doing a case conference with the patient, the carer, and the OT, or the psychologist, those sorts of things. So don't forget case conferences. And so that's just kind of the bare minimum, really, over 12 months that are things that you can bill. So yes, it's time consuming. Yes, it's hard, but you can be remunerated for a lot of the work that you're doing, and same with the registrars. So it's important to be having these discussions with the registrar about appropriate billing and being strategic with everything as well. So thank you very much. I really appreciate for you listening to this presentation. I hope that you've learnt some valuable information, have some more valuable tools that you can be discussing with your registrars now, so that you can take this away and really look after your patients with disabilities. So this is the GPSA teaching plan that I have written up, which includes most of the references that I've talked about. So I really encourage at some point in your registrar's training that you actually specifically sit down and go through this with them, encourage them to look at this, because it's an area of medicine that's not done well. But as we've talked about today, there's lots of things that are not done well with patients with disabilities because they're not done well broadly. Like I mentioned before, about I have seen this trend with registrars not doing very good examinations at the moment. And I think that's often related to COVID and doing lots of telehealth. So I think focusing on a broad range of skills will actually help this area as well. So focusing on examination skills, history taking skills, assessment, coming up with broad differentials lists, all those kind of things are really, really important broadly and certainly come into play in this area of medicine. So I encourage you to go and have a look at that. Click on the links, because particularly that podcast series with the psychotropic medications, people with intellectual disabilities, it is so good. And that 3DN website with UNSW has got some fantastic resources in it as well. But the links that are there are some really good articles. There's a short movie as well to watch, Jeremy the Dud. I encourage you to watch that as well. And I encourage you to be talking about this with the registrars. Oh, and the last thing I wanted to mention is that there is a special interest group with the RACGP, Disability Medicine, and there is some incredible incredibly experienced doctors on that group. So I really recommend that if this is an area that you're interested in, or you've just taken on a group home, or you are starting to see more patients, or you suddenly feel like really excited by this area, yes, actually, I want to do this. I really encourage you to join that special interest group, because they do have really good resources, doctors there that can answer lots of your questions as well. So thank you very, very much. And I appreciate your time and listening, and all of the best with looking after these patients. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We'd love your feedback. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please give us a rating and or a review. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast with your colleagues. If you'd like to ask a question or suggest a topic, you can reach out to us via our social channels. Simply search GP Supervisors Australia on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram or Twitter. GP Supervisors Australia is supported by funding from the Australian Government under the Australian General Practice Training Program.